cryptic note that your team wants to share time and didn't know who was going to do rebuttal, so you've got 20 minutes. Okay, and you can do whatever you want with it, but that's your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Todd Burns on behalf of Barry Kabov, and our plan is to divide the time evenly, and that I was hoping to save 2 minutes of my 10 for rebuttal.
Okay, good
So I'm hoping to sit down at 8 minutes and let...
I know how it goes. We'll try to stay out of your way. Go right ahead.
And then we're going to address separate issues, but the issues apply to both of the Kabovs.
Okay. Is that true? All issues apply to both brothers?
Yes.
Okay, that's good to know at the outset. Go right ahead.
And I'm going to focus on some of the issues related to prosecutorial misconduct, and I want to begin with some of the issues related to Courtland Gettle, who was the prosecutor's cooperating witness. And Mr. Gettle's testimony had a narrative arc, which in a nutshell was that in 2012, he'd never been in trouble with the law, he'd been sober for 18 years, his son died, and in his grief, he began using copious amounts of drugs. And that involved him buying massive amounts of opiates from the Kabovs, $10,000 to $30,000 a month over the next 2 years. And as a result of that drug abuse, he lost his way and committed some real estate frauds to the tune of $50 million.
Counsel, let's suppose, for purposes of my question, the quite plausible view that Gettle just lied his head off, and they were serious lies about how he was tipped over by his son's death. I know the prosecutor says, "Oh, he didn't exactly say that," but I don't know. Red light that to me. And the prosecution just hid this stuff from you. All the bad stuff about Gettle being a real estate crook and about his son not being dead at all, and they just hid it from you. Let's assume all that. In this case, there's so much physical evidence that I'm wondering if it matters. I mean, you should have been allowed, in my hypothetical, to use the evidence the prosecutor hid from you to show that nothing Gettle says should be believed. He's a liar of the worst character. Nevertheless, would it matter because of the physical evidence?
Well, and I think, yes, it would. And one of the specific points of misconduct with respect to Gettle, I think, is especially telling, which is that he said he purchased these massive amounts of opiates. And when he was confronted on cross with the fact that his credit card record showed $72,000 worth of purchases for steroids, he said, "Oh, I went over my other bank records show withdrawals of cash and wires to purchase the opiates. And I went over that with the FBI agents before trial." And there was no evidence of that provided, of course, defense counsel, because it doesn't exist. There was this spreadsheet provided post-trial that shows this review and shows what Mr. Gettle told the agents. There's no opiates. There's no drugs sold to him by the Kabovs.
Much more fertile ground for cross-examination had you known that. So, but Judge Kleinfeld's question, as I understand it, is let's assume that they found that the jury knew all of that and this witness lied about lots and lots of stuff. And, you know, the district court ruled on this, as you know, and said he wasn't a star witness. He's not pivotal. There's so much other evidence of guilt. So what's your best response?
And I understand that. I wanted to preface my response by saying it's not just a matter that the jury could say, this guy's just a big liar. How can we believe anything he said? It's that his core testimony about buying opiates from them was completely undercut. So it's not just that he's a liar. It's that he lied about the central point.
The only customer.
Well, he was the only one who testified, the only alleged customer who testified. And that, I think, leads to the answer to this question, which is the government had a 4-year investigation involved in this case involving 3 different federal agencies. They were only able to produce 1 alleged customer. That's Courtland Gettle. They produced no video or agent testimony of surveillance of drug transactions. I mean, in my experience, I've been doing this for a little while. Federal investigations that are proactive, not reactive, have, if someone is dealing drugs for a long period of time, have surveillance, have confidential informant, have evidence, hard, direct evidence of these drug sales. Here, all they have is Cortland Gettle. And not only that, in their closing...
Well, no, they have a whole lot of evidence that the Cabos bought a lot of drugs and sold a lot of drugs and delivered a lot of drugs.
I should have spoken more carefully. Here, the only evidence of a customer who was buying drugs illicitly from them, the only direct evidence of that was Cortland Gettle's testimony.
They don't need direct evidence. The standard jury instruction on circumstantial evidence tells the jury they don't need direct evidence.
Well, that's true, but what my point is, I think a juror could reasonably question, well, what's going on here if these guys are selling these drugs illicitly?
Whether a juror could reasonably question is whether the outcome would have been different or might have been different, depending on what she testifies.
Well, the standard under NAPU is if there's a reasonable likelihood that it could have affected the verdict.
Yeah, and that's what I want to know. When the jury hears about how much drugs the Cabos bought and how much they sold and how much they delivered and the shady ways in which they accomplished the deliveries, why would it have made a difference whether they knew, as they should have known actually, that Gettle was not a witness to be trusted?
I'm totally
unsympathetic with the prosecution, frankly. I found your argument quite persuasive on that.
Sure.
But it's hard to see why it would have mattered.
Well, I think if the prosecution had corrected the false testimony presented, which they were obligated to do, that would have been very much a black mark on the good faith of their case and on what was going on, and that would have caused doubt. And I think when you combine that with the fact that, well, if these gentlemen are engaged in illicitly selling drugs...
Okay,
sure.
Imagine yourself in the jury room, as I suppose that test that might have made a difference requires you to do. And one of the jurors says, this Gettle, the guy's a total liar. And the other jurors say, well, you know, yeah, probably is. So what is going to be the next part of the juror's discussion? So what if he's a total liar?
And I think part of that discussion could obviously be, look, there may have been something untoward or illegal going on with the pharmacy. There may have been failure to follow civil regulations, etc. But that could well have been undertaken by the pharmacist, who was not called as a witness, who was never even questioned, Michael Lowe. It could well involve Mr. Lowe and Dr. Altamirano, who was never presented as a witness.
Can I stop you there for a second? What did the jury hear about the manner in which Dr. Altamirano wrote these prescriptions to folks who said they didn't know him, hadn't seen him? What exactly did the jury hear about that?
Well, I think what they heard is that many of the prescriptions were written by Dr. Altamirano, and that they heard on occasions that they heard evidence to suggest that the Cabals had a social relationship with Dr. Altamirano.
Did they hear from some of the people who had been former classmates of the friend who said they'd been victims of identity theft and they'd never met Dr. Altamirano?
Yes, there were four such witnesses.
Okay. And did they hear the nature of those prescriptions, the amounts, the quantities, the substances prescribed?
Yes, they did.
Did they hear anything, any testimony describing him, and it might be an email, describing Dr. Alter, the brothers asking him to come to a bar or a restaurant and to bring his prescription tablet to write prescriptions?
I believe there was at least one text chain about meeting Dr. Altamirano at a bar.
I appreciate your candor. I've gone all through this. I have notes everywhere. I know this is very, very important to the parties, but I'm just following up on Judge Kleinfeld's questions, it seemed to me that this evidence was really devastating, and I want to give you a fair chance to respond to it.
Well, again, I think it comes back to that the jurors could have well concluded that there was something illegal going on at the pharmacy without concluding that the Cabals were involved in selling a massive amount of opiates illegally.
Okay, because of the theory that they had hired a pharmacist, and I appreciate hearing your theory on that very much. I want to tell you both that I am concerned about the jury instruction argument. I'm not sure where that's going to come in, but
I think that's the first thing that Ms. Voights is going to discuss.
Just real quickly on the Gettle testimony. Is it possible there was a transcription error? Because he does refer to his son later in his testimony.
I don't think so, and I don't think that the government thought there was a transcription error. If you recall, in the district court, their first excuse for why they didn't correct it is, oh, we just thought he was confused. Well, that's fairly generous to a $50 million fraudster. They've abandoned that excuse on appeal and said, oh, the jury could have figured it out themselves. Well, defense counsel didn't figure it out, so I don't know how the jury was supposed to figure it out. I would say, as emphasized in the brief, there are a bunch of situations here where something was amiss with the prosecution, and they should have corrected things. And when you deliberately don't correct things, as this court said, reversal is virtually automatic. And I think it bears throwing in there that if you're willing to put your neck out there as a prosecutor and not correct these things, they must be important to you.
Well, speaking of putting your neck out, let's be fair. What's your strongest argument that the prosecutor knew that witness testified falsely? Which statement is it?
Well, I think the son thing is most obvious, especially because they changed their excuse from district court.
Wait, what else?
Now, I think that the bank spreadsheet is an obvious one, too.
Why?
Because he says during his testimony, I've gone over these bank records with the FBI and shown them where the massive withdrawals are to buy these drugs. Defense counsel doesn't have that. That should have been turned over to Rule 16 if it existed. Well, I don't think it's Brady because they must have known when he was saying that was untrue. And I think probably why.
What was untrue? That he hadn't gone over the spreadsheets with
him? No, that his bank records don't show cash and wire withdrawals to buy these drugs. And I think you could say it was Brady, but I think logically what happened is they didn't anticipate he was going to lie in that way. They didn't anticipate he was going to say that, so they didn't turn over the spreadsheet. But once he went and lied, then post-trial they said, ugh, this is Brady. It's really that boo. Turn it over after trial. But what they should have done is corrected it at trial, and they didn't. And not only did they not correct it, they leaned into Gettle on their closing. I mean, you know, at a certain point, you push it too far. But as far as materiality, I think, you know, the district court never applied the right standard to any of these many instances. And I think, given the complicated record, what would make the most sense, probably practically, is for the court to review those things, indicate what standard of materiality applies, and then remand for the district court to apply that in the first instance.
I want to be candid, because this is important to your clients. On my scorecard, speaking for one, the Napu and Brady claims are very hard sells, but I'm concerned about an instruction.
Okay, well then I will take that hint and sit down.
On the instruction, I still have a question for you. I'm a little confused, because I think maybe I'm mixing up two instructions. One looked like invited error because the judge gave the instruction the defense submitted.
Ms. Voights is going to address the instructions. I could stumble through it, but it wouldn't be very edifying.
Thank you for your
argument. Thank you.
My name is Ann Voights, and I represent Dalibor Kabov. My plan was to address the jury instructions and the remaining issues. Given the court's interest and the amount of time left, I will focus purely on the instructional issues, though I'm certainly happy to answer other questions if the court has them.
Thank you.
So,
my big question.
You will have the time you need, so go ahead.
Thank you.
I have two questions, basically. One is, I thought your argument was pretty good under Ruan, that to extend all the way down the instruction. But I was worried because at least one of these instructions was submitted by the defense, so it's invited error. Straighten me out, educate me.
Sure. So from the beginning, the defense actually did dispute whether you should have this language in it about the usual course of professional practice and whether they should be instructed that the Kabovs should be treated as medical professionals when, in fact, they were not. I'd refer the court to ER 4558.
Also, just to, not to interrupt you again, but you, now we're talking about the distribution instruction.
Yes.
Okay.
So you're not responding to my question right now.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You're speaking past each other. I think the question went to the importation instruction.
My apologies.
Not a Rife
issue. My apologies. So with the Rife issue, no, I think the court actually, I think they did specifically say the dispute in the district court was over whether the lack of an appropriate license was something the Kabovs had to know. That was clearly an issue.
What's the best? So now that we have Ruan, your team had the burden of production. So, and it's always difficult with the district court judges, always feel bad about this. This it did not have the benefit of Ruan. Nobody did. So here we are. And I think your argument is that you didn't get the instruction you're entitled to. You've made that argument in the briefing, but you'd still have the burden of production, right?
Right.
So could you speak to what evidence in the record would have entitled your clients to this instruction?
Sure. I think there are two things. First is the fact that they were a licensed pharmacy. And second was the fact that when you look at the communications about the importation, nothing suggests that they understood that this that they needed a license. So when this goes to the question of what they had to know and what they were required to know.
Being a licensed pharmacist is irrelevant to whether or not you're licensed to import.
But the question is whether they knew that and whether they...
Is it, or is it... I read Ruan is saying at the burden of production that you were authorized to import.
So I think it is the burden of... Ruan has sort of, I think, two elements. One is what you, the burden of production as to whether you were authorized or not. And then second is the question of mens rea. Did you know that?
Right. I think, as I read Ruan, you have to satisfy the first part, the burden of production of authorization. Then you get the second part, which is the mens rea. Do you read it differently?
I do. I read it as requiring it for both. And so there's a question of whether it was authorized. And there's no dispute, really, I think, that they did not actually have a separate authorization. And the question is, did they know that?
I mean, and on that point, to just follow up on Judge Bloom, I don't think there's any evidence otherwise, right?
There's no evidence that they actually had a permit
to import. Right, okay.
They were a licensed pharmacy.
So is it enough, if you have evidence in the record, I think there is some evidence in the record from the email chain, and certainly it was argued in closing, that they didn't act like Guy. The email chains show that they didn't act like, I think, Dalibar didn't act like he knew otherwise. And this is the email we all know about. Speaking to the importer, make sure you put everything down. I'm in California. Use his correct name. Use his correct address. So that's the part of the evidence I'm talking about. He didn't act like a guy who thought there was a problem.
Correct.
But is that enough?
I think so. The burden of production is a relatively light one, and it shifts immediately so that the government has to show beyond a reasonable doubt that they have shown.
Right, but before you shift the burden under Ruan to the government, you have to meet the burden of production. I just want to parse the question Judge Bumate is asking, because I share it with him. Is it enough that there's evidence in the record to show that your clients thought they had the license to import, or would there have needed to be evidence in the record to show that the license covered that?
So the answer is yes to the first question and no to the second. They needed only to know. So the question was, did they?
Okay. So you've answered it directly. I'm not sure I agree, but I haven't figured it out. Your position is yes on that question. Wouldn't they have also had to have evidence in the record to show one of the exceptions, that is, that the importation was for a legitimate practice or medical practice, scientific practice?
So I think if they had shown that they had a permit to import it, then yes, it would have been adequate. There's also the testimony that from one of a doctor who testified during the defense case that it was difficult at times to obtain the medication.
Okay, wait a minute. Are you talking about Dr. Lee, the person who prescribed steroids for AIDS patients?
Yes.
Okay, so we're getting past each other again. If you could go back to the decision tree, I was asking whether or not you would need evidence in the record to show that the importation was for a legitimate medical practice. Those are two different things, medical practice or other legitimate practice. And I think there is some evidence in the record. All I can see is Dr. Lee, who testified that he imported through them, ordered through them, all three kinds of steroids that makes up counts 6, 7, and 8, and that he administered those directly to his patients in his office. So I'll grant you all of that. I've gone over the record carefully. But could you go back to the decision tree, because I'm still not sure that we're lining up there. When I asked you whether you get to this, you don't get to this evidence in the exception unless there's evidence of the license. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
No, so let me clarify. So I think that there are two sort of separate prongs. And where we are, there is one, did this meet some of the other criteria?
Of the exception? Of the statutory exception for importation?
Because the exception, the question is of, when we're talking about the exception, we're really talking about the knowledge of the exception here. And so the question is, have we shown enough between the testimony of Dr. Lee, between the email that you referenced where Mr. Kavav showed you know, ask them
whatever. You produced enough evidence to entitle yourself to this instruction that you wanted, and the instruction
yes.
you wanted was that your folks, your clients, weren't guilty because they reasonably believed that they had, or the government hadn't shown that they couldn't import with this license.
That the government had not met their burden of proof
right.
to show that they knew that they were not authorized to import these drugs.
Okay.
All right. And that is an element of the offense, not an affirmative defense.
This instruction that you are contending was mistaken. This was not an instruction that was provided to the court and requested by the defense.
No, Your Honor, they did actually ask for an instruction.
When you say they, I don't know what you mean.
I'm sorry, the defense counsel did. It's at 20 ER 4563 through 68. And the court said.
Wait a minute.
I'm sorry.
Again.
It's volume 20 of the ER, pages 4563 through 68.
What if we decide that the instruction that was proffered and rejected was not correct either? Does that matter?
It doesn't, because I think it still puts the issue into play, which is what do you have to show about the defendant's scienter? Everyone, not just the court, was functioning without the benefit of Ruan.
Okay, so, right, but and I think your point is you didn't waive it. Your folks were trying to run this defense, which was, it's a rehafe Ruan. In retrospect, now it's a Ruan defense. And your strongest argument that is that just the statutory language alone and the rehafe Ruan reading is that the government had to prove this intent, this mens rea. And I think you've run through all the evidence that you think would have entitled them, would have satisfied your burden of production.
Yes, I think that coupled with the fact that they were a licensed pharmacy, they were entitled
what
to order.
What evidence did the jury hear about that, about the pharmacy's license?
So they did hear about it in part through the government's case, about the fact that they were not allegedly not complying with some regulations. And that's part of what makes this.
Is that where I would find it, Dr. Dang?
I think Deborah White as well.
Which one's Deborah White?
So Deborah White was the inspector who actually carried out the inspections. Dang was an expert witness who talked about the regulations that apply to licensed pharmacies.
All right. In the supplemental briefing that you filed, you argued the other instruction, which is, I think, why you went there a minute ago. That post-Ruan, you didn't argue the importation instruction. You're arguing the distribution instruction.
Well, I think Ruan applies to both. I mean, I think Ruan sort of amplifies the Rahafe argument that we made in our principal briefing, which is that there is a element of scienter that applies here, and that element applies to all of it, including the absence of authorization to import.
What should I make from the fact that the importation instruction is not included in your supplemental briefing? I don't think it is, anyway.
It's not. We were given five pages, so we're... I think the court should apply the law that controls, which is Ruan and Rahafe, that they feed together. But even if this court were not to apply Ruan to the importation, we think Rahafe alone means that there is error here by the failure to apply the requisite mens rea standard to the element here of the lack of authorization, the lack of an import license.
So the government, when you're arguing essentially that the government didn't meet its burden of proof, and you're asking us to vacate these convictions for counts 5, 6, 7, 8, I think.
Yes, that is correct.
All right, so
or
the government doesn't have the burden of proof if you haven't met your burden of production. Do you agree with that?
I do, but I think that the burden of production is not a heavy one. I think we've certainly put in enough evidence from first the emails, the exchanges about the importation, which showed no intention to hide, no intention, no use of a false name, no use of false address.
Where's that in your briefing? I didn't see that in your briefing. To us, at least.
Got it. That was included in, I'm sorry.
I didn't see it in the rehave section, so I don't know if it's somewhere else.
I'm happy to, rather than, since I see that, I'm getting into my...
We had trouble, too, because the briefs and the excerpts are so excessively long, you really can't find anything and can't figure out anything. It's really hard. Help me with something on Ruan before you sit down. What the Supreme Court did was reject a whole bunch of government arguments that would basically make a doctor who prescribed too much dope guilty of a crime. case of being a doctor. And they rejected all the government stuff about how the doctor has to show it was reasonable, or the jury has to be instructed that the doctor has to be shown to have been unreasonable or not to have met the objective standard of his profession. For some reason, I forget if I ever knew exactly what burden of production the doctor met and how he met it in Rouen. Was there anything other than, I'm a doctor, I prescribe narcotics for pain, that's what doctors do. Was there anything else that the defendant produced in Rouen?
So the court actually remanded to the appellate court to make that determination. So what the Supreme Court did was articulate the framework and explain that there was this burden of production. And then the burden shifted to the government to show it beyond a reasonable doubt. We'd submit that here, if the court has questions about the instructional error.
What about what the burden of production is? Rouen says there is such a burden, but I don't understand what it is, and they draw some analogies to other cases that suggest it's not much of a burden. But do we have some kind of test that we can say, well, the Supreme Court told us this is the burden of production, and the Kabobs did or did not meet this burden?
I think the cases that the Supreme Court cited to, I think the court can look to other analogies for what the burden of production normally is for defendants in criminal cases, and it's generally a light one to avoid sort of shifting the burden of presumption or shifting the burden of proof. And with respect to Judge Bumate's question, I was going to offer to submit a 28-day letter with the citations.
As my review of the briefing is that you did argue the licensed pharmacy, but I don't think I saw anything about the communications with importers. So if you could point me to where that is, that'd be great. So I mean, assuming that you did not argue that, and all you had is the licensed pharmacy, is that enough to meet your burden of production?
Yes.
And why?
Because, again, it goes to whether you believe that you have authorization. If you are a licensed pharmacy, you know that you can order drugs. Do you understand the distinction between being able to order drugs from a U.S. wholesaler versus one that's abroad? And that is the classic sort of regulatory distinction that I think is one that draws a distinction between what's innocent conduct on the one hand and culpable conduct on the other.
A lot of drugs do come from abroad. So a little pharmacy in Fairbanks, Alaska is ordering drugs that I guess a lot come from Switzerland. A lot of the generics come from Israel. Are they importers, or do they just deal with some American distributor down the chain, or what?
So here we know that they dealt with U.S. wholesalers in addition to the ones that were imported. And so there's nothing in the record that suggests that they understood that there was a legal distinction between what they could order in the U.S. and what they would need to be able to order from abroad.
They had some kind of import permit or papers, didn't they?
So they believed that they were acting in good faith, consistent with the regulations. Neither of them were pharmacists.
That wasn't exactly my question. My question was, did the pharmacy have some kind of importing papers?
Not that would have authorized the substances at issue here.
Okay, sorry, if I could go back to that, the communications. Your argument is that to the Chinese importers, they said, just put everything down. We're a pharmacist. Is that communication you're talking about, that email chain?
Yes.
So how does that show that they thought that they had an importation license?
It shows that they weren't aware that they were doing anything wrong, because if they didn't ask them to hide what the substances were, they didn't ask them to send them to a fake name or to a different, they ordered them the way that you would any other order that you were placing in the normal course of business. It doesn't show any sort of consciousness of guilt, and we see that is more than enough to meet what is generally a light burden of production. Because ultimately, this is an element on which the government bears a burden of proof. And to the extent that this court has questions about it, we'd submit that one thing this court can do, given that the record is incredibly large and complicated, is simply remand to the district court to apply Ron and Rahafe and make a determination about whether or not this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Court, Benjamin Beer of the United States.
I want to begin just by touching on the three standards that apply for the false testimony and new evidence claims.
If you would like, I'm really interested in the instruction.
That's fine. Let me just make one point then, or two points. The first is, for the NIPUA claims, the district court found, whatever you make of the false evidence claims, that the government didn't know that the testimony was false. That finding is reviewed for clear error.
I thought you knew that the government did know that the son was alive, and the guy testified in a way that I think any ordinary person would understand to mean, gee, his son died, and between his son and this pharmacy, that tipped him over. He fell off the wagon.
Let me make 2 points there.
I mean, you can make an argument, well, he didn't really say that. He didn't exactly mean that. It's kind of ambiguous. I don't know. I read it as just government covering up a lie.
Let me make 2 points to that, Your Honor.
I was shocked by it, frankly.
Yes, Your Honor. The 2 points are, first of all, the government told the district court that while he represented that his son suffered from cystic fibrosis, we didn't know for a fact whether the son was dead or not. But the second point is more important, which is if you look at the cross-examination at 3105, the defense attorney asks a series of questions premised on the son being alive and elicits testimony about the son being alive. And that's important because, first of all, none of the parties understood at the time of trial.
I thought he told the government's investigator that his son was alive, and then he told the jury his son was dead.
No, Your Honor. What we told the district court was that he talked about his son having suffered from cystic fibrosis, but we didn't know one way or the other whether the son was
so
dead.
So you were just giving him the benefit of the doubt instead of giving the benefit of the doubt to whether you needed to tell the defendants what was going on here.
No, Your Honor. The point I'm making is that the government didn't even understand at the time of trial for him to be saying that his son was dead. I don't know if he misspoke or not, but the cross-examination...
I don't care if he misspoke, if he lied, if he told something untrue, or even if it wasn't exactly a lie, it was just a false statement. You had to tell. And, gosh, I don't understand why you didn't just give the defense the file. I mean, this guy was a crook.
So what the cross-examination at 3105 reflects is extensive testimony about his son being alive at the time of trial. If the defense believed that was false, the earlier testimony, he could have crossed the witness on that. But even
that's
more important...
like more dancing around. We have a case, LePage, it's called, where we specifically say that the ability of the defense to cross-examine when they and perhaps expose the false statement is not enough. To avoid an APU error, the government has to stand up and tell the jury because of the government's great credibility when they present a witness.
Here's my point.
It just looked really dishonest to me, and it tilted my view of your whole case.
One of the points I'm trying to make is if the witness was in fact trying to deceive the jury about his son, he would have persisted in that lie later.
I'm not just talking instead, about the witness. I'm talking about the prosecutor, the lawyer, for the government as well.
I don't understand, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
You have to make sure that defense counsel has the information that you have that would impugn the credibility or prove or tend to be exculpatory regarding your witness. If you have a witness and you know that this guy is not to be trusted in many ways, you should give that information to the defense, and you shouldn't just let him lie to the jury and then see if the defense can persuade the jury that he's a liar.
Your Honor, the district courts found that for virtually all of the defendant's Brady claims, we produced the evidence at issue. The district court also found that the government didn't know this witness lied.
You didn't give...
And in addition to that, I submit that whatever that statement said, neither of the parties understood it at the time of trial to be false. The witness... to whatever extent it was...
As I recall, they didn't know at the time of the trial that the son was alive, and the statement sounded like he was dead, but the government's investigator before the testimony of the lying witness did know that the son was alive.
Your Honor, I understand why on a cold record it would appear to you that the witness lied. I submit to you that the record reflects that none of the people in the court believed the witness lied, that the witness gave correct testimony, correcting any misimpression, and that Renzi says an innocent...
any misimpression. So the defense said, gee, I understood you to say your son was dead. is the son alive or dead? And the witness said, well, he's alive. I don't remember that occurring during the trial.
Your Honor, look at Exhibit Excerpt Record 3105. Defense counsel asks an extensive line of questions about the son being alive, elicits the fact that he had spoken with his son right before trial, elicits the fact that one of the reasons he wanted to testify was to be with his son, elicits the fact that he feels comfortable that his son will be taken care of by his ex-wife after trial. That one line of testimony read in a cold record has to be read in the context of the entire examination.
What you're saying is the jury knew by the end of the examination that the son was, in fact, not dead.
Correct. And the parties believed that the witness hadn't testified falsely. And Renzi says, even if...
Do you think there was no possibility of a transcription error here?
I think, to be honest with you, there either was a transcription error or he misspoke. I don't know. But my point is, it doesn't matter because whatever error there was later clarified. And Renzi even makes it clear, even if he did misspeak, an error that's an honest error doesn't rise the level of a NIPU violation. And he clearly didn't intend to mislead the jury because why would he have answered those other questions the way he did? So I'll get to the instructions. Let me outline to start with how the Controlled Substance Act is structured. The Controlled Substance Act provides that it's unlawful to knowingly distribute a controlled substance, and then it creates an exemption, except as otherwise authorized. And there are several exemptions that exist in the statute. The one relevant here is the federal registration.
And this exemption is designed for doctors and pharmacists because they distribute controlled substances every day.
That's correct. Right. Yes. And so what Ruan did was essentially resolve a circuit split about what the government has to show in these distribution cases involving prescriptions. The Ninth Circuit and Feingold and other circuits recognize a subjective standard, knowingly and intentionally acting outside the course of practice. I believe it was the Fifth Circuit whatever other circuit was in Ruan, applied an objective standard. And what the Supreme Court did is effectively resolve that circuit split in the Ninth Circuit's favor by recognizing that where a defendant is, in fact, registered, the government bears the burden of showing knowingly and intentionally acting outside the practice. So Ruan really didn't change anything in terms of this circuit's elements instruction.
Ruan doesn't say that the government has to prove it's outside the standard practice. It says the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant knowingly and intentionally acted in an unauthorized manner.
Yes,
it's not just proving that he acted in an unauthorized manner. It's proving that he knowingly and intentionally did so.
Right. So what the statute...
So what you said about Ruan, that's not quite right. I mean, this is the words of Ruan.
Well, what you look to is the regulation defining what is authorized or not. I believe it's 1306.04. And that provides that a prescription is valid if it's issued in the court.
Counsel, you're not hearing
judgment. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
No.
Yeah.
What the Supreme Court says is that is false and that what the government must prove is not that it is, in fact, unauthorized, although it has to prove that. In addition, it also has to prove that the defendant knowingly or intentionally acted in an unauthorized manner. That's a mental element rather than a measure against a statute or regulation or standard practice for what's authorized.
What I would submit, Your Honor, is to...
Do you understand the distinction between proving that it's authorized and proving that the defendant knew or intended it to be unauthorized?
Yes, Your Honor, of course. And I submit, look to page 2382 of Ruan, where it recognizes that in carrying that burden...
2382, I'm looking at the U.S. reports, the official version.
I see.
What's the page number there?
Your Honor, I would have to go...
Never mind. I'll take you too much.
You know, what the Supreme Court says is, I'll just read it. You know, the government, of course, can prove knowledge of lack of authorization through circumstantial evidence, including, and I'll paraphrase now, by reference to objective criteria such as legitimate medical purpose and the usual course of professional practice. And then the Supreme Court goes on to say, as we have said before, the more unreasonable defendant's asserted beliefs and misunderstandings are, especially measured against objective criteria, the more likely the jury will find that the government has carried its burden of proving knowledge. So what the Supreme Court recognized in Rouen, much like what the Ninth Circuit, this court recognized in Feingold, is that there's two showings that the government...
They didn't take away the mental element with that language. I did read that language, and they didn't take away the mental element. They just said you can prove it by circumstantial evidence that because this is this dispensation of controlled substances was so unusual and so far from what's authorized that you, the jurors, ought to believe beyond a reasonable doubt that he knew very well.
The point I'm making,
for example, if you gave somebody who came in and he had a prescription from a dentist after he got a wisdom tooth extracted, instead of for 2 or 3 days of narcotics, for 2 or 3 months of narcotics, that would be kind of out there, and it's circumstantial evidence that the pharmacist should know there's something wrong with this prescription.
Yes, Your Honor. And the point I'm making is what the statute and the supporting regulations provide is that what is unauthorized in this context of a prescription is a prescription that is filled outside the usual course of practice.
No, it's filled with the wrong mental element. I mean, in the wisdom case, they typically give you Tylenol 3 for 2 or 3 days. And if you had the prescription for 2 or 3 years worth of Tylenol and you gave it, you being the pharmacist, to the purported patient, it's not that you're giving him Tylenol that goes beyond the normal practice of 2 or 3 days. The problem is you should know that this is not a bona fide, legitimate prescription because you know that they ordinarily go for 2 or 3 days.
So I agree, but I agree within the context of what the statute requires. There's a hybrid showing. So first, we have to show that the conduct was, in fact, unauthorized. That's the objective element with respect, and that looks to that term, the usual course of practice, which is objective. And then the second showing is, did the defendant knowingly and intentionally or act without authorization? So did the defendant know, for example, here, that these prescriptions, drugs were being dispensed outside the course of practice?
Did he know it was unauthorized?
Correct. And respectfully, the defendants were creating bogus prescriptions here in the names of identity theft victims. That was the case here.
Okay, but did the instruction require the jury to find that beyond a reasonable doubt the defendants knew that filling these prescriptions was unauthorized?
Yes. The instruction required the jury to find that the defendants knowingly and intentionally acted outside the course of professional practice, which by definition, by necessity, means that they knowingly and intentionally act without authorization, because that is what authorization is, dispensing within the usual course of practice. I do want to note...
Does the government concede that Rouen applies to 852, the 852 charge?
Yeah.
They are different, and they're different textually, they have different requirements.
Well, the reason Rouen applies in that context is because it addressed the implication of Section 885 of the statute, which is what provides that the government isn't required to negate an exemption until the defendant...
Is your answer yes?
The answer is yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it addressed that statute, providing that basically what the statute...
But do you see what the difference is? Because in the importation charge, you have to have an actual license to import. That seems like a very binary, objective thing. And versus the 841, where you have to prescribe it in the course of business, or whatever the actual words. So that seems much more subjective, whether or not you know you're doing something within the profession. But whether or not you have a license to import seems very binary, very stark. So why would the Rouman rationale apply in that case?
Your Honor, in both contexts, you have to have a license. So in the context, a pharmacy can only dispense a controlled drug pursuant to a federal registration number under Section 822. That is what creates the exemption that the government then has to disprove. And then in order to import a drug, similarly, the pharmacy has to have that same type of authorization specific to importing controlled drugs. And what Rouen holds is that unless the defendant proffers evidence of an exemption, this registration exists, the government isn't required to disprove that fact, to prove non-exempt status.
Rouen say that. I just recall it saying burden of going forward with something and not defining the burden.
Your Honor, what Rouen recognizes...
It's slippery. And you just keep talking right past this point. It's slippery because because Judge Bumate is trying to call your attention to the evidence about the existence of the license. And in Guam, there were physicians who were defendants. And here we have two people who don't pretend to be pharmacists. Mm-hmm. Right? They hired a pharmacist. So this is an important point, and all three of us have tried to get you to focus on
right.
it. But it just so you understand where we're coming from, right? there's a difference there. So I think everybody appreciates the argument about Rouen and that mens rea, and of course the government argued that mens rea, I hear the word willfulness in the instruction, was surplusage. So, you know, these instruction arguments have our full attention.
I understand.
Okay. So, understanding that, you know, you're not charged with 20/20 hindsight, and certainly at the district court, is now we all have the benefit of Rouen. So that's why we're trying to get you to recognize, and certainly Judge Bumate has been training mightily to get you to focus on this part.
I'm sorry that I misunderstood.
You're not. It's a lot, but it doesn't help to all three of us yet. But that's why Rouen's different, right? And those two defendants were physicians, and I think that was uncontested. They were licensed physicians, and the question was, did they know that they were prescribing in a way that Judge Kleinfeld's been speaking about? In this case, we don't have licensed pharmacists. We have a pharmacy that was licensed, and this is why I was torturing opposing counsel to say, you know, what evidence did the jury have about what that license was? And there is, as you know, there was, I'll just tell you, just so you know where we're coming from, in the record available to us, not having been in the trial court, it's clear that the jury understood that the pharmacy had a type of a license. And there's this email exchange that we've talked about where it indicates that Dalibor certainly didn't indicate, he didn't act like a guy who thought his license didn't allow him to import, right? But is it your position, and you just answered yes to Judge Bumate's question about whether Rouen applies to both importation and distribution, so this is important. Is it your position that the evidence in the record shifted the burden to the government? That is, did the defense have to have evidence in the record of a license that allowed the pharmacy to import in addition to the email string that shows that, I think, does show, I'll just tell you, that the defendant, at least one of them, thought that license allowed him to import?
Your Honor, the answer is no as to importation. That the burden, the reason is because
what question?
That the burden never shifted as to the importation.
So does that mean you think they had the burden to produce evidence that their license did allow it to import?
So
as well as that they thought it did?
Yes, Your Honor. That not even that they thought it did. Rouen recognized the crucial role that authorization plays in but what I'm
trying to understand your answer in terms of innocent drugs. Suppose a pharmacy uses a pharmacy tech who is really just somebody who fills orders or dispenses prescriptions over the counter or counts pills, that kind of thing, prints labels. That's what the pharmacy techs do. And it's a big enough pharmacy so they have a tech who does the ordering. And the tech has been ordering some really common and standard Coumadin, a blood thinner, perfectly. It's not a controlled substance, has been ordering Coumadin from a distributor in Michigan and discovers he can get Coumadin a whole lot cheaper from, I can't remember that, maybe a Teva product, that maybe the Teva in Israel distributes the generic Coumadin, or maybe an outfit in India, I can't remember which. But the tech discovers they can get it a lot cheaper from the distributor in India or Israel. And so the tech puts in that order. How does anyone know that it's unauthorized and that they need a special paper from the government to order the Teva Coumadin, or even know that it is authorized, or even know that there's any authorization at issue? How do they know that?
Your Honor, I'm not sure what the law provides in the context of your hypothetical.
I'm thinking a prosecutor can look it over later and look at the regs and say it was authorized or it was not authorized. But since Rouen says there has to be mens rea when they place the order, it's not enough just to show that it was unauthorized. I'm wondering where you would get the mens rea from.
I think the sticking point here is that the presumption or line of questions is that it's merely by virtue of the fact that they were that there's a physician or a pharmacist that makes the conduct authorized or not, and that's not what the statute provides. The statute provides that what makes a physician's handling of controlled substances authorized is the federal license. You have the federal license or you don't. So if a physician, I've had cases like this, if a physician were to write a prescription without a federal DEA registration number, that conduct would be unauthorized and good faith would be irrelevant. So in the so what matters for the importation cases, it was undisputed that the defendants didn't have the registration. They didn't have the license that would make their conduct authorized. And so by virtue of that...
when you say it's undisputed, that's what I'm trying to get. Could you be more specific?
So
is it your position that they would have had the burden to produce something otherwise and they didn't? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Or do you mean the government affirmatively produced evidence? What did the jury hear? Nothing?
So my point is, not only did they never produce evidence that they had that registration, but the government introduced undisputed testimony for Spencer Shelton that they didn't have a registration. And it is because of that that their conduct was unauthorized and the burden never shifted back to the government. And so that is why the importation counts shouldn't be reversed, even if the court were to be limited to those
something,
counts.
Something, yeah. And I'm not sure whether the standard is colorable or exactly what it is, something to show that they didn't know that it was unauthorized. And then the government has to prove, yes, they did. You keep shifting back to the objective part. It is, in fact, unauthorized. And we keep asking you about the scienter aspect.
You know, the point I'm making is that the government doesn't need to make an enhanced showing of scienter unless it is objectively true, or at least the defendants produce evidence of that, that their conduct was exempt by virtue of having a registration.
I want them to have to prove that it was unauthorized in order to shift the burden of proof to the government to prove that they knew it was unauthorized.
You know, that's what the statute requires.
No, it doesn't. Under rules.
Could I ask a separate question because I'm worried about the sequence? It seems to me the defense did proffer an instruction. The government, I have the pages, but I don't want to take a lot of your time, I'm sure you're aware, argued that the willfulness was actually surplusage and they did not need to make this showing. We all know now that was a wrong guess. It was that wasn't correct. So I'm interested in the sequence about whether there was, when the instructions rulings came down, and I have that conference here. I've got the on-record discussion about the jury instructions, and I have the argument that the defense counsel made in closing, which, of course, wasn't evidence. We reviewed the evidence that was in the record. Was there anything pretrial that would have, this is, I'll hear from defense counsel as well, but was there anything pretrial where the district court signaled any kind of call on what was or was not going to be required for the government to prove on this point? In other words, are they going to be? Is the defense in a position to say the reason we didn't introduce the evidence is because we didn't know that was going to be the instruction?
No, Your Honor. The government's consistent point to the court was the defense hasn't met its burden of production, and for that reason, the
You argued that it was surplusage. I mean, got that at the end of the trial. You're arguing that
the willfulness language in the drug statute doesn't import cheek willfulness standing alone. What creates the enhanced scienter burden? Is the defendants making a burden of production that their conduct was exempt? So I don't think our position about that term willfulness was incorrect.
What law do you have for burden of production for exactly what the burden is?
Your Honor, Section 885, which provides that the government isn't required to establish non-exemption until the defendant produces evidence of exemption. Section 822, Section, if I'm remembering right, 952, provides, or maybe it's 957, in the context of distribution and importation, provide that you have to have a registration to have your conduct be authorized, and the defendants didn't have a registration as to the importation counts.
Hold on, because there's more than that.
Yeah.
The instruction the jury actually got strikes me as strict liability.
It is not strict liability. Oh, sorry, go ahead. Yes.
It was that the defendants knowingly brought or caused to be brought into the United States a controlled substance. And the prosecutor argued to the jury this was a no-brainer. And the prosecutor argued to the jury this was a no-brainer on these importation counts because of that email string, because Dalibar knew very well he was bringing, you know, this controlled substance into the country. So I'm concerned about that. Again, I'm not trying to cast aspersions. I get that this is 20/20 hindsight. But I am concerned about whether the jury was, you know, misled in hindsight about the required, the requisite burden of proof and what they did or did not need to find. I'm going to ask opposing counsel that same question, so would you like an opportunity to respond?
Yes, this court in Jefferson recognized that the mens rea element is knowing importation of a controlled drug, and that was what...
So you realize I'm asking you, should I be concerned that the jury got a very wrong message from the government's instruction and the instruction the court gave and the government's argument?
No, because the court correctly instructed the jury on the elements, which is what we had to prove as knowing importation. If the defendants wanted to argue they acted in good faith in the context here, that's a sentencing argument, I suppose, but because they didn't meet their burden of production, it didn't shift what the court had to instruct the jury on. I know I'm over time. I want to make just two points.
I'm not done with you yet.
Okay.
I've got a couple of questions. So I know you've been asked this over and over, but just to be clear, what is your belief that Ruan requires if they produce evidence that they had authorization to import? I'm talking about online importation, or is it they have to just produce evidence that they believe they had authorization to import?
They have to prove evidence of authorization in the form of a federal controlled drug registration, or I suppose maybe there's another exemption like medical research that applies.
So under that theory, then they didn't meet that burden, and so it never shifted to the government.
Correct.
Okay, so assuming that that's wrong and it's about that they have to prove just a mens rea that they thought they had authorization, assuming that's the law and that's what Ruan says for importation, they've offered two pieces of evidence that shows that the burden has shifted. One is the licensed pharmacy, and two is communications with the importer, the Chinese importer. Do you agree that that meets the burden for shifting?
Your Honor, if...
The burden of production.
Burden of production to then shift it to then... Shift it to the government.
I understand.
Your Honor, understanding that I disagree with the premise of the question, if the court were to find that the district court was required to provide the additional elements instruction, then the court should reverse as to those counts only 5-8.
Okay, so you do think that that meets the burden of production?
I don't. I think that because the defendants never the Supreme Court in Ruan recognized the crucial role that authorization plays, and because
the premise that it's just knowledge, the belief that they have authorization,
right?
Is the fact that they had a license for a pharmacy and their communications with the Chinese importer, does that meet the burden of production?
No, because it's not enough to show mere belief. You have to actually show, I've got the license, here it is.
I'm saying,
yes.
But pretend that that's not the law. Pretend, because I think it's an open question whether Ruan requires objective authorization or just they have objective evidence that they believe they had authorization. Assuming it's that latter, are those two pieces of evidence enough to shift?
No, because the defendant's objective belief isn't enough. They either were authorized or not.
Logical sense. You just said twice that the defendants have to prove that they have authorization before the burden shifts to the government to prove that they didn't know that they were acting in an unauthorized manner. It's illogical.
What I mean by that is simply that they have to carry the burden of production. I'm not suggesting...
You're saying the burden of production is they have to prove they were authorized, but Ruan says, no, all they have to, they don't have to prove anything except to put reasonably at issue whether they thought they were authorized. You keep trying to shift this to something that's objective and to ignore in any practical circumstances the Ruan holding on scienter.
My point is that you have to make a burden. You have to produce evidence that you were, in fact, authorized, whatever your intent or good faith or not. You either got the license or you don't. They did it.
What does that leave of Ruan?
Well, what Ruan recognizes is once that production is satisfied, which it is in virtually all these cases because you have the registration.
Once you prove you were authorized, then the government has to prove that scienter. But once you're authorized, there's no case. You never get to scienter.
Well, that's... I disagree because the statute regulation provides an exception to the exception, which is in the context of distribution, not importation, just to take that, acting outside the usual course of practice. So once you have the registration, now I have to prove that you acted outside the course of practice and knowingly and intentionally did so. So the burden shifts to me to make that showing. That's what Ruan was getting at, and that's what I submit the statute.
I think the easy way to say Ruan doesn't apply to this importation statute, I think.
Except that he's already taken the other.
Well, the point I'm making is Ruan applies only in as much as it applied 885, which it also applies in the context of importation. I'm not suggesting that Ruan actually addressed importation. There isn't even a usual course of practice standard for importation. That's only for distribution.
So I think you may have misspoken earlier, or at least least I heard you say it's a different thing.
Yes.
Let me just ask you one final, I promise it's the final question from me. I can't bind my colleagues, but opposing counsels, when I asked about why I think the importation instruction is not included in the supplemental briefing, she said because we were limited to 5 pages. If that's correct, I've forgotten it, frankly. Should we order supplemental briefing on this? My colleagues now are going to be kicking me under the table.
Your Honor, respectfully, I told defense counsel before those briefs were submitted that I was planning on addressing importation. If Your Honor's wish...
Counsel, I'm just asking the question. Do you think we need supplemental briefing on this question?
It sounds like it would help to clarify what's required here, so I would like to do so.
We've imposed somehow a 5-page limit?
For this last supplemental brief, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, well, that may be part of the problem. Again, now that we see how this has shifted out, that may be something we're going to want to discuss. Would you like to wrap up? Because
you're
massively over your
time. I know. Just two last points.
Go
last
ahead.
Minute.
Go right ahead.
For the distribution instructions, the first is, if you look at excerpts 45, 43, 45, 44, that's the defense motion to exclude Dr. Dank's testimony, where they explicitly tie that argument to the instruction, which goes to why the whole thing is waived anyway.
I have it here.
And the second point is, counts 2 and 3 are distribution counts involving sales to the Ohio customer before they had the registration.
Yeah.
There was no enhancement for that. So whatever Your Honors think, it has no impact on those counts. And again, I apologize if I misunderstood your questions. I was doing my best.
No, you did just fine.
Okay, thank you for your time.
About to get better.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not really.
No.
How are you going to, who's going
to? I just want to address the sun.
Wait, I'm going to give you 2 minutes. I just don't know. I'm not going to give you both 2 minutes. So that's not fair. One or the other of you is going to do the rebuttal. You want to confer first?
No, I think I can tell where the court's interest is. So I think
yes.
This points.
I mean, it's the rule. We follow our rules. We're big on rules, so.
5 seconds.
Sure.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You'll have the time you need.
Thank you. First, if I could address a point that Mr. Davis is going to make, I'll
yes.
do it very briefly, which is just that. That it wasn't clear from the record that there was only one son. I think a reasonable reading of what
point
said
taken. We've been over this thoroughly.
Understood.
We understand.
I will move on. And I will also say that we're certainly happy to provide supplemental briefing on...
Was it a 5-page limit?
It was.
Okay.
The government's brief was over that. Ours was...
I don't know that my colleagues would feel that's necessary. I just wanted to inquire.
Okay. We're certainly happy to. I think we recognize these issues are complicated and that everyone, including the district court here, was functioning without the benefit of Ruan at the time. We'd note that, you know...
I think in response to one of Judge Bumate's questions, opposing counsel said, if, there's quite a hypothetical, he said, then you should reverse and vacate these convictions. And we're talking about 5, 6, 7, 8, I believe. I think he was talking about 5, 6, 7, 8. But I think earlier you said if we have this problem and think this instruction was infirm, we should remand to the district court to make a harmlessness finding. What's your position?
So our position is that the court should reverse and
that's not what you said last time, is it?
I'm saying as an alternative, if the court doesn't want to itself undertake the harmless error analysis, which we recognize is complicated and difficult, it could send it back to the district court to make factual findings on that point.
But you agree that harmlessness finding would need to be made?
Yes.
Okay.
Either by this court or by the district
court.
Even
if the structural error on the instructions. I thought instructions are structural and it doesn't matter. But.
So if there, under Nieder, if there is an element that's omitted, then the court reviews, it's a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which applies in this case. So it's not categorical or structural error, but it's a very difficult standard for the government to meet.
Fair enough. Thank you.
With respect to the government's comments about this being a subjective standard, that is a new position that was not what the jury was told, and that's part of the real problem here with both the distribution counts and with the importation counts, because what the government told them in closing was that this is an objective term. The jury was told that again and again, and not only is it an objective term, but it was a term that was treating the cowboys who were not
medical professionals. Was that supported by the instructions, or was the defendant free to show? No, it's not.
I think when you look at the instructions, they also made it clear that it was an objective standard. At a minimum, it was certainly ambiguous as to what was required, and that, I think, is the heart of the problem
here. And this is the distribution as well as the importation?
So yes, the distribution suffers from the same problem as in Rouen. The importation has the fundamental problem that both Rouen and Raif and the government has conceded that Rouen applies to importation, which is that when you look at it, you know, the instructions that they were given really turned it into a strict liability statute. As long as you knew that you were importing something, you didn't have to know that you were doing it without authorization.
They had to know it was a controlled substance.
Right. They had to know it was a controlled substance, and they had to know that they were importing it. But it did not require you to understand that you were doing so without authorization. And here we have an incredibly complicated regime with many regulations where they were licensed to buy things in the U.S. and where they were acting as if there was no problem.
Why wasn't it harmless error? Because the circumstantial evidence was overwhelming to prove mens rea on account of the vast quantities and the deceptive distribution methods.
So I think I'd divide that into two answers, one for the distribution counts and one for the importation counts, if I might. So first, for the importation counts, there was nothing that showed, the mens rea there is, did they know it was unauthorized to import these, regardless of the purpose or to be used? And that is not clear at all. That was, they were not correctly instructed, and we think that the government can't show that that was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. With respect to the distribution counts, as my colleague pointed out, even if you think that the evidence amounts to proof that something that happened, the question is, can it be attributed to the Khabovs? That's the problem, because Gettle was really the link between them and what may have happened at the pharmacy.
The email chains, I think, and again, I have notes everywhere. I will go back and check this, but I think the emails that say, you know, come meet us at this bar, bring your tablet to Dr. Altamirano, were from the defendants to the physician, weren't they?
They were, but I think there was no more beyond that, you know, and
the
so...
The juries also heard evidence, I think testimony from, I think counsel's conceded four of the identity theft victims whose, you know, names are found at the pharmacy for whom he wrote prescriptions and testified to the jury. They'd never met him. They didn't know him.
That's correct. I think that actually cuts in their favor. They weren't, there was no connection between them.
No, they didn't know the physician, is what I'm saying. And I'm really just following up on Judge Weinfeld.
But they also didn't know the Khabovs. And so I think the question is, can you tie, even if you believe that that is evidence of the amount of evidence of distribution, is it harmless?
The Khabovs were emailing. This is why I think it, you know, does, I appreciate your defense as to the licensed pharmacist they had hired. But the Khabovs, I think, are on those email chains to this physician who was writing this extraordinary number of prescriptions to people who've never met him, right?
I believe that there were text chains.
Okay.
And he was also treating some of their family members, so there isn't...
That, yes, isn't it? Those, if they're texts, they're texts, but they're communications from the defendants to that physician.
They are. Okay. They are a handful. And as I submit, I think without more context, they don't support the sort of extraordinary sprawling case here, and they certainly don't cure the error in the instructions when it comes to distribution.
Okay, fair enough. Let me just...
I just have one more question. Isn't there a strong argument, though, that Rouen does not apply to importation because it is a different worded statute? It has a different that the defense, because, you know, I think Rouen talks about some of these elements could be affirmative defenses, and so why wouldn't the idea that you have an objective authorization to import be an affirmative defense, and why does not that objective requirement take this out of Rouen?
Because there's also the subjective mens rea requirement. That's what Ron acknowledged is sort of a key element of any criminal offense. And so that
Raif. But not for everything. It was very specific. For example, they talk about Ron and Raif talk about whether or not the distinction is whether or not it separates wrongful conduct from innocent conduct. And the fact that you have a license doesn't mean that you're wrongful or not, right? If you import something, that could be. The fact, to me, the fact of whether you have an authorization to import is a ministerial requirement. It has nothing to do whether or not you're blameworthy or not, or, you know, you're culpable in some way. So why would the mens rea apply to that?
I think that makes it akin to Raif. I think it does make the distinction. If you do not have the proper permits or proper licensing, then you are guilty of a crime, in this case, a felony. If you do, then you are not.
Well, and Raif, so there's the fact of he wasn't being a felon,
that makes it culpable. His unlawful status.
Right. Or was it a lawful, forget that. That makes it wrongful. But here, whether or not you have a license to import, why does that make it wrongful?
I think fundamentally it goes to whether you had permission to bring it in to the United States when you're dealing with controlled substances, which are a highly regulated area.
Importation counts, are 5, 6, 7, and 8, one's a conspiracy charge, but 5, 6, 7, and 8 are the importation counts, and those pertain just to the steroids that came from China.
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay, so when Dr. Lee testified, the defense expert said he purchased those three types of steroids from the pharmacy, this pharmacy. He testified that he wasn't distributing those, except he was administering them directly in his office to those patients, right?
Correct.
So my understanding is that's your evidence of the defendants having, that the jury heard, that the importation substances, which is just those three, it's not anything compounded in the pharmacy, that that was imported for a legitimate purpose.
What this hung on was whether they had, what made it criminal in this case was the jury's determination. Well, the jury wasn't asked to determine that. That's
right,
the fundamental
right,
problem.
Right.
Is whether they could do so.
Was there evidence that that this pharmacy or the defendants imported anything other than those three steroids?
I would have to go back and verify that.
Were they charged with importing anything other than the three steroids?
That's just the steroids.
Sorry?
No, it was just the steroids and the importation counts.
Okay, I needed to clear that up.
Thank you.
I think we're finally ready to let you off the hook, all of you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I know we really tortured you today, but this is an important case. We really appreciate all of your efforts. We recognize how important it is to all people concerned. So if our questions seemed annoyingly protracted, it's because we take our job really seriously and appreciate your understanding. We'll stand in recess.
Thank you.